the value of a liberal contribution to the fund. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, we finished then, of course, the second of Corinthians chapter 8 in the course of our studies so far. And just to summarise then where we've got to in the story, and for those who perhaps haven't been with us to this point of time, we've been looking, of course, remember, at the study of Paul the arms bearer concerning the work of the apostle in gathering together the Jerusalem Poor Fund. We saw how it was the earlier collection taken up from the ecclesia at Antioch in Acts chapter 11 that provided the stimulus to thought that eventually blossomed forth in the apostle's mind and was later to become, in its fullness, the Jerusalem Poor Fund itself. To be taken up, in fact, many years later, but the incipient idea, the seed idea of that, was first found in the joyous collection that came from Antioch to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 11. We saw how the spirit of Judaism that reared its ugly head at the Jerusalem conference and in the Jerusalem ecclesia and elsewhere would have confirmed the thinking of the apostle of the need that now prevailed upon the ecclesial world to bring Jew and Gentile together. And not just to bring them together, but to do so on the basis of the right motive principle for life. And that power was, of course, to be the power of grace at work in the life of the believer, as opposed to the compulsion of law. And the apostle saw how that the gathering up of this fund could at one and the same time be influential in bringing together Jew and Gentile, and at the same time to illustrate the principle of what grace could inspire as opposed to what law could compel. And then, of course, we moved into the second of Corinthians chapter 8 as we looked at the apostle's arguments to the ecclesias of Achaia in order that he might stimulate the brethren of those ecclesias to give generously to the fund. We saw in the first 12 verses how the apostle appealed to them that they might give an enthusiastic support of the fund, and in support of his argument, he brought forth the example of the wonderful spirit of generosity and grace that was seen in the Macedonian ecclesias, and perhaps from Philippi in particular, of whom we believe that Lydia was, in fact, in many respects, the driving spirit with regard to their attitude to generosity. And so the apostle brings forth in the early verses of chapter 8 the generous example of the Macedonians. And then also the supreme example of our Lord himself in the 9th verse and the way in which he selflessly gave himself for the needs of others. And then in our study on Tuesday evening, we saw brought forth the example of the commissioners that were going to go down on behalf of the apostle to complete the collections in the ecclesias of Achaia. We saw their spirit of earnest care, remember, their bubbling zeal, their absolute care for the truth that bubbled over and outside of them as these three men, whom we believe to be in fact Titus and Luke and Tychicus, made their way down to the ecclesias of Achaia, that their own infectious enthusiasm, which they had inherited from the apostle, might be passed on to those ecclesias and from thence to the very spirit of the collection itself. We saw also, remember, the marvellous spirit of the apostle in verses 20 and 21, how that although his heart's desire was that he himself should go to Achaia to complete these collections, he knew that that wasn't possible because of the spirit of the Judaizers. And you'll remember that even though it must have hurt the apostle deeply because of the criticisms that had been levelled against him, that if it was the best thing for the truth to stay back, then that's what the apostle would do. And so remember, he utters those marvellous words that he wanted to avoid any blame being attached to the fund itself, and the apostle would therefore do, and gladly do, whatever would best advance the cause of the truth. You know, brothers and sisters, that ought to be always our guiding spirit in life. No matter how difficult it is, what will be best for the truth? That's what we should do. Well, now, in the ninth chapter, we're going to take up in the first seven verses the threads now of the apostle's argument as he moves on to some further ideas. And in particular this evening, what we're going to look at is how the apostle now moves on to stress the value not merely of contributing to the fund, but of making a liberal contribution to the fund. And he's going to give them in these first seven verses some marvellous exhortations to the spirit of careful preparation that was necessary, and also to the spirit of generous liberality itself. Let's just break those verses up then in a little more detail to see what it is that we're dealing with this evening. So the 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and the first seven verses, the value of a liberal contribution to the fund. So in the first two verses, the apostle is going to give them an encouraging reminder of their early zeal to minister to others. He's going to remind them of their own spirit at an earlier time. He's going to say, look, can't you remember what you really felt like earlier on this? Let's get back to that spirit and see if we can't complete the collections. And then in verses 3 to 5, well, he's going to go on and say just that, because in verses 3 to 5, he's going to talk about the need now for their collections to be carefully prepared and to be ready for the time when the apostle himself would make his appearance in the area of Achaia. And then finally in verses 6 and 7, he's going to give them an appeal that they might give with a joyful, spontaneous liberality. It's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? But that really is the spirit of this exhortation. He wants them to give with a joyful, spontaneous liberality. And remember, brothers and sisters and young people, the whole point, of course, of these studies is this is not an exhortation concerning money. Not really. It's an attitude for life itself, in the truth. It may be the giving of our money as well. But it could also be the giving of our time, of our energy, of our abilities, of our love, of our service. In whatever respect the truth asks of us, we give with this spirit, including our collections. Well, let's have a look at what the apostle says there in the first verse then of the ninth chapter as we begin his arguments this evening. He says, therefore, in verse 1, for as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you, for I know the forwardness of your mind. You know, when you really think about verse 1, and you think about what the apostle says, it actually sounds a little bit strange. He says, for as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you. Weymouth says, it is unnecessary for me to write. Jerusalem Bible says, there's no need for me to write. Now, when you stop and think about it, you think, well, why would the apostle be saying there's no need for him to write when he obviously is writing? And therefore, if he was writing, there must have been a need. So why does the apostle say there's no need to write when he's just about to do just that? He's writing two chapters. Well, you see, you've got to read the verse carefully. What he says is, as touching the ministering to the saints, it's not necessary for me to write. In other words, what the first verse is telling us is that the ecclesias of Achaia had no problem with the principles of the fund itself. They had no problem about the idea of giving for the needs of the poor. The issue at stake in the ecclesias of Achaia had never been the concept of giving to assist others. The whole problem, the whole matter rather, of a willing mind had never been an issue. Verse 2, I know the forwardness of your mind. And the word means willing. I know the willingness of your mind. That had never been in doubt. The problem was that the Judaizers had, of course, suggested that the apostle himself had ulterior motives with regard to the collection. And the thing that had brought the collections to a grinding halt in the ecclesias of Achaia was they weren't sure about the apostles' integrity. That's why they'd stopped. They thought that he was embezzling money from the fund. And so you see, what the apostle is saying in this verse is, well, look, he says, now that we've been reconciled, now that your trust of me has been restored, now that you're confident concerning my integrity again, he says, I know that it's not necessary to write about the actual idea of giving for the needs of the poor. I know that you support that principle. And the apostle was confident that now that they had been reconciled, that their interest and their enthusiasm in the fund would rapidly revive. And he writes on that basis. He assumes that that will be the case. And so he says, verse 2, he says, I know the willingness of your mind, for which I boast of you to them of Macedonia, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal hath provoked very many. I boast of you to them of Macedonia. Here he says that Achaia was ready a year ago. You see, in the 8th chapter, we have a reference to this, in fact, in the 10th verse. In the 8th chapter, he says, and herein I give my advice, for this is expedient for you who have begun before, not only to do, but also to be willing a year ago. So the collections had actually started in Achaia a year before, and they had started with enthusiasm. Was the response of the brethren of the ecclesias of Achaia that they wanted to give generously for this worthy purpose. They'd begun a year before. Now the apostle says in chapter 9 verse 2, he says, I boasted of you to them of Macedonia that Achaia was ready a year ago. You know, in fact he says, verse 2, he says, your zeal hath provoked very many. The word zeal is a very powerful word in the Greek here. It's actually the Greek word zelos. Z-E-L-O-S, zelos. It actually means, taken from its literal root, and the root certainly conveys the sense of the word here, it refers to either the boil of liquids or the glow of solids. That's a very strong word, isn't it? Either the boil of liquids or the glow of solids, when of course they're hot. He says, you were red hot for this a year ago. You were on fire concerning this idea, and your zeal hath provoked very many. I suppose the word provoked in a sense is a little unfortunate, because we tend to use the word provoked perhaps in a negative sense in the English today. But the real meaning of the word provoked here is simply to stimulate. In fact, the Revised Standard Version renders the phrase, your zeal hath stirred up many. You know, when you stop and think about it, what the apostle says here in this verse is very, very skillful and tactful. See, what he says is this. He says, you know, he says, it's a funny thing. I actually boasted to the ecclesias of Macedonia that you were ready a year ago, and how zealously you'd started those collections. Matter of fact, they gave on the basis of the fact that they'd heard about your zeal, he says. Now, remember what he's already told them in chapter 8, verse 2. Remember what he said there? He's already told them that the Macedonian ecclesias, in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. So he's already told them that the Macedonians have given a massive contribution. Now what he says in chapter 9 verse 2, he says, you realize of course that the Macedonians gave such an enormous collection because, well, they were so impressed with your zeal. And of course the implication of the verse is to say, well, how embarrassing it would be if after their having been provoked by your zeal and have given so generously out of nothing, that they turn around and find that you actually haven't really given anything at all. How embarrassing that would be, says the apostle. Don't you think? You see, here's the apostle at his eloquent bet. Remember, he can't force them to give any money. This is going to be the collection inspired by grace. But he can embarrass them. And that's what he's going to try and do. And so he reminds them of how generous the Macedonians have been and says, well, really, they did it on the basis of what they've heard about you. It would be very awkward if they found out that, in fact, you haven't done anything after all. And so he says in verse 3, yet have I sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain on this behalf. Now, remember we said that in the first verse, the apostle, the issue at stake was not the issue of the fund itself. When he says it's not necessary for me to write to you, now, you've just got to follow the thread of this through. Verse 1, it's not necessary for me to write to you about the fund. Verse 3, yet. Verse 4, lest. Verse 5, therefore. Verse 6, but. You see those words that commence these verses that now follow. Yet, verse 3, lest, verse 4, therefore, verse 5, but, verse 6. So when he says in verse 1, I didn't have to write about the fund, these, however, now are the things that he did have to write about. And there were two issues that the apostle was concerned to write to the ecclesias of Achaia about. And the two principles were not the fund itself, not their willingness, but the speed of their collection and the size of their contributions. So verses 3 to 5 is going to talk about the speed of the collection. That is what he's writing to them about. And verses 6 to 7 is going to talk about the size of their contributions. So verse 1 he says, I don't have to write about the fund, but there are a couple of things I do need to talk about. How quickly we can get this finished and how large it ought to be. And so we have those joining words, yet, verse 3, lest, verse 4, therefore, verse 5, but, verse 6. Well, let's have a look at what those verses go on to say. So he says, verse 3, yet have I sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this behalf, that, as I said, ye may be ready. I have sent the brethren. Who are the brethren? Well, of course, we know that the brethren are the delegates that have been referred to in the 8th chapter. So the brethren that were sent were none other than Titus and Luke and Tychicus, who were the three appointed men in the previous chapter sent down to Achaia. I've sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain on this behalf. And so the apostle was concerned that the boasting that he had made concerning Achaia may in fact be an empty boast. You see how often he refers to that? Verse Chapter 8, verse 24. Our boasting on your behalf. Verse, chapter 9, verse 2. I boast of you to them of Macedonia. Verse 3. Our boasting of you. End of verse 4. This same confident boasting. The apostle, you see, it's a lovely way that the apostle, he's absolutely confident in the fact that they will respond. That's the way he writes. He assumes that they will respond. He's very positive in assuming that they will give generously. He doesn't believe anything else. But what he was concerned about was that that might be an empty boast. That is, that the Achaeans professed to have zeal, but never in fact practiced it. And so he says, I've sent the brethren because we do want to get this finished off, as you'll appreciate, lest our boasting of you should be vain, that as I said, verse 3, ye may be ready. You notice that the apostle's obviously anxious about this business concerning the readiness of the fund. He's anxious that it might be ready. We might just have a look at that. If you come back to the 1st of Corinthians chapter 16, we just follow through the plans of the apostle here and see why it was that the apostle had a concern about the readiness of the fund. He said, I've sent the brethren so that the collections might be ready. Now notice what he says in the 1st of Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 2. We've looked at this verse several times already, haven't we? But there are other things to find yet. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store as God hath prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. And when I come, whomsoever ye shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality, charis, grace, your grace unto Jerusalem. Verse 4, and if it be meet that I go also, they shall go with me. So the apostle says, I do want you to get the collections over before I come, but he says, I'm not sure at this stage, verse 4, whether I'm going to Jerusalem. Notice that. If it be meet that I go also, they shall go with me. But he's not sure. But by the time he writes the epistle to the Corinthians, Romans, by the time he writes Romans, we come to the 15th chapter of Romans, and by this time the apostle has now come down to Achaia. Titus has already gone with the second epistle, Luke has gone with him, and Tychicus. The fund has been completed. The apostle has now come down himself, and we're told in the 24th verse of Romans 15, Whensoever I take my journey into Spain, I will come to you, for I trust to see you in my journey, and to be brought on my way thitherward by you, if first I be somewhat filled with your company. But now I go unto Jerusalem to minister unto the saints, for it hath pleased them of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints who are at Jerusalem. So by the time the apostle writes Romans, he is going. He wasn't sure in the 1 Corinthians 16. Now he's definitely going to make the journey himself. And in fact, if we come to Acts chapter 20, you'll appreciate that there was at this stage some sense of urgency as far as the apostle was concerned. You'll remember what we read in Acts 20 and verse 3. We're told that after the apostle came to Achaia, following after Titus and the other delegates, we're told there in the third verse, he came into Greece and abode 3 months, Acts 20 verse 3, and when the Jews lay wait for him as he was about to sail into Syria, he purposed to return through Macedonia. So remember, he was going to catch one of the Passover ships from the port of Cenchrea in order to be back in Jerusalem in time for the Passover, but there was a change to his plans, remember, and he went back to Philippi, no doubt to Lydia's house, and spent the time of unleavened bread there. But he doesn't know all that at the time he writes the 2 Corinthians. He doesn't know that there's going to be a change of plans. When the apostle writes the 2 Corinthians, all he knows is this: that he needs to get the collections finished because he wants to come down, he wants to exhort the brethren, he wants to pick up the bags, he wants to gather the delegates, and he wants to jump on the boat and go. It's not until he got down there he found he couldn't do that and he had to change his plans. But he didn't know that that change was coming up when he wrote the 2 Corinthians. So coming back to the 2 Corinthians chapter 9, his concern therefore was, at this time he says, look, I'm running to a tight timetable, I'm not going to have a lot of spare time. I do want everything to be ready by the time I arrive. And so he was anxious that everything should be kept to the timetable that he had originally planned, now that he had decided that he himself would be, in fact, making the journey. And so he says in the 2 Corinthians 9, verse 3, I have sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this behalf, that, as I said, ye may be ready. Actually, there's more to it than that, because the word ready here, actually, well, that's perhaps not quite the full sense of the Greek term. The word ready that's used here is the Greek word paraskeuatos, and it's only found 5 times in the whole of the scriptural record. And the sense of the term might be better expressed by the word preparation. It's used in Acts chapter 10 and verse 10 in the sense of preparing a meal. It's used in the 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 8 in the sense of preparing for battle. And then it's used 3 verses in a row here in the 2 Corinthians chapter 9. It's used in verse 2 here that Achaia has made preparations, translating from Nestle there. In the 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 3 at the end, that, as I said, ye may be prepared, reading from Rotherham's translation. And in the 4th verse, we have it in the negative form, as the 4th verse goes on to say, lest haply, if they of Macedonia come with me and find you unprepared, not ready. It's the same word in the Greek. So the thing that the apostle was concerned about was not simply that the collections were ready, but that they were properly prepared in order to be ready. In fact, one of the cognate words for this term is the word used throughout the Gospels to describe what is known as the day of preparation. It's a cognate word in the Greek. So you see, it's more than just saying that I want the collections to be ready. You know, when we use that term, we tend to imply that we simply want them finished off. The apostle didn't just want them finished off. The apostle wanted them gathered according to the right spirit. And the right spirit was that they needed to be carefully and thoughtfully prepared. Now just have a look at this then in terms of what the apostle is aiming for here. Here's the spirit of the apostle's words. It was needful for the whole affair to be conducted graciously, with the careful setting aside of what God had prospered them with, then a thoughtful and joyful giving of that reserved portion to the fund. the proper organisation of this activity of gathering throughout the ecclesias. Accounting for and sealing the proceeds, the prayerful selection and appointment of suitable delegates, all this required ample time and adequate preparation so that the collection should be ready at the appointed time. So you see the force of the Greek word. It wasn't just the readiness on time, but that spirit of preparation that would make it ready on time. That's what the apostle wanted. That was always the spirit of the apostle. So he says in the fourth verse, lest haply, and that means perhaps in a more modern English word would be lest perhaps if they of Macedonia come with me, which they were, and find you unprepared, and I'm just going to leave out the italicised, the bracket section for a moment, we should be ashamed in this same confident boasting. The word means to be disgraced. So what the apostle's saying in the fourth verse, he says, look, it's so important that all of this is ready according to the timetable that I've got. He says it would be a most embarrassing thing if those that come with me from Macedonia find that you're not ready. He says, I'd feel disgraced. Absolutely humiliated after the confidence that I've shown in you, says the apostle. And then you see the little bracketed section there. That we say not ye. It's a little clumsy in the authorised version. But this is how the Jerusalem Bible puts it. The Jerusalem Bible translates the bracketed section, I believe it's correct textually, to say nothing of yourselves. So let's read that verse again, and this time capture the textual sense of the phrase. Lest perhaps if they of Macedonia come with me and find you unprepared, we should be ashamed in the same confident boasting to say nothing of yourselves, says the apostle. In other words, he says, I'd feel disgraced, let alone how you'd feel, says the apostle, if they of Macedonia should come and find, in fact, that you're not ready. What a dreadful thing that would be, says the apostle Paul. You know, there's a lovely spirit in all of this. It's a funny thing, isn't it? You know, if we'd been asked to take up collections for the poor, remember Galatians 2 verse 10, they would that I should remember the poor. The apostle could have said, okay, all right, we'll get that organised, but I really have a lot of other important things to do. The apostle could have simply organised, you know, a little bit of collection work, perhaps administered through Titus or Timothy in various places and given it over to them as a delegated function for them to get that money organised and off to do it. That's not what the apostle did, was it? The apostle always wanted to do the best he could for the truth. He spent 3 years organising this. He went over all the provinces, ecclesia by ecclesia. He gave them careful instructions. He told them how to collect the money, how to seal it. He told them the day that they were to gather it on. Here he makes appeals on the basis of reference to the history of Israel and to the example of our Lord Jesus Christ to inspire them to those collections. The apostle made an enormous project of this collection, and he did it all himself. Because that spirit of careful preparation was always the apostle's spirit for anything that should be done in the truth. And so it should be for ours. The apostle wanted everything perfect. He wanted the collections taken in good time. He wanted the brethren to have given themselves joyfully to that activity. He wanted the delegates chosen carefully. He wanted the bags counted up carefully. He wanted everything to be just so, because this is the work of the truth, says the apostle, and it must be ready. Carefully prepared. Is that our spirit? Is that how we approach our responsibilities and our tasks in ecclesial life? It should be. And there's so many things in ecclesial life where we have an opportunity for cooperating together. Take just one thing by way of illustration. A special lecture. Just one lecture. Now think of the spirit of careful preparation that's needed for the accomplishment of something like a special lecture. We assume, of course, in the first instance, that the lecturer has fulfilled his responsibilities and that there is at least a lecture worthwhile hearing. That's stimulating from the record of Scripture. But there's much more than that, isn't there? What about the doorkeeper? Is he there on time? At least half an hour before the meeting? Because sometimes strangers turn up surprisingly early for public lectures. Is the doorkeeper there? Has he opened the doors? Is the room too hot? Should the windows be open? Is the seating all right? Should the fans be on? Is the screen adjusted? Is the overhead there? Is the extension lead there? Is there a spare bulb in case the overhead projector? There's all these little things that need to be planned. Is the table in the right place? Has the water been set out? The chairman comes along, he's got to make sure that all of those things are in place, in order. What are the pamphlets that we're going to advertise tonight? Do we have stocks of them? Are they out there on the display board? Do I have one to show after the lecture? Have I checked the hymns? Are they on the board? Does the organist know? Is her voluntary appropriate? And then there's the sisters that are going to prepare the supper. Have they remembered the milk? Are the cups out? Is there tea there? Have they got plates of sandwiches and cakes? And it's no good remembering to turn the hot water on at the end of the lecture, that's too late. It has to be organised, doesn't it? So in fact, there are people out there before the lecture's even finished, so that the moment the lecture concludes, and the closing voluntary finishes, out come young people with plates of cups and teas and sandwiches. Would you like a cup of tea? Would you like? And before a stranger's even had the chance to get up from their seat, there's a cup of tea in their hand and a piece of rock cake in the other hand, and someone's talking to them about the lecture. It's all got to be organised. There are so many little details, you see, that need to be rightly put together in order that that lecture should be successful. The spirit of careful preparation. Whatever we do in the truth, be we an organist or a Sunday school teacher or a doorkeeper or a chairman or a speaker or even the cleaning of the hall, can still be done with that same spirit of careful diligence. That was always what the apostle did. He always wanted to do that well for the truth, because it was the truth. And so he says, verse 5, therefore, he says, I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren that they would go before unto you and make up beforehand your bounty, whereof ye had noticed before, that the same might be ready as a matter of bounty and not as of covetousness. He says, I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren to go before unto you. When he says go before what? Or before whom? Well, of course, in the context of what we know about the apostles' own travel plans, we believe that the apostle means that they were going to go before him. So I exhorted the brethren that they would go before I come, and that they would make up beforehand your bounty. What a lovely descriptive term he uses there. He actually really means their cash. But he doesn't call it cash, he calls it, you see what the margin says, and the margin is correct, he says your blessing. That's what it was. He says, I want them to make up your blessing, and that's exactly what they were going to give. It was going to be their open expression of goodwill towards the recipients. You know, there's an interesting thing that comes out of that. It was all to be given according to a willing mind. Verse 2, I know the willingness of your mind. You know, if you come back to Exodus chapter 35 for a moment, we have an important spirit here with regard to the offerings that were so to be given. I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren that they might go before unto you and make up beforehand your blessing. Well, there's an interesting principle that comes out of that phrase. In Exodus 35, we're told in the 21st verse concerning the giving of items for the tabernacle. It says in Exodus 35, verse 21, and they came, every one whose heart stirred him up, and every one whom his spirit made willing, and they brought Yahweh's offering to the work of the tabernacle of the congregation, and for all his service, and for all the holy garments, and they came, both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted, and brought bracelets, and earrings, and rings, and tablets, jewels of gold, and every man that offered an offering of gold unto Yahweh. And so the key was, you see, verses 21 and 22, that they had to be willing-hearted. Do you know what they actually brought? Where did the bracelets and the earrings and the rings and the tablets and the jewels come from? They were, of course, the filthy lucre of Egypt, weren't they? When the children of Israel left Egypt, they spoiled the Egyptians, and these things that they gave on this occasion was in fact the wealth of Egypt. But you see, the principle of Exodus 35 is that when we give for the service of the truth with a willing heart, our offering is sanctified by that attitude. And it's not the filthy lucre of Egypt anymore. It's an offering unto Yahweh. And that's what our cash is as well. And you'll remember that we saw last Sunday that there is in fact a tremendous appropriateness as our collection bags themselves go around on a Sunday, and into the bag we put money, but it's not money anymore, because if we give it with a willing heart, it's sanctified as an offering for God. And that's how the apostle saw it. He says, I don't want your cash, he says, I want your blessing. These brethren are going to come to make up your blessing. And even our material resources, brothers and sisters and young people, if given according to the spirit of willing-heartedness, is sanctified for the service of the truth. Come back to the 2 Corinthians chapter 9. And so he says, I thought it necessary, therefore, he says, because you are aware of how concerned I am that the collections be ready at the appointed time. He says, I thought that they should go before I come, and make up your blessing, whereof ye have noticed before, says the fifth verse. But most other translations translate the phrase literally from the Greek, taking the 20th century New Testament translation, which you have already promised, as the literal form of the Greek, rather than whereof ye had noticed before. That they'll come to make up your blessing, which you have already promised. New English Bible says, your promised bounty. So the apostle gently reminds them that they had promised these collections a year before. They'd begun so well. He says, all I'm going to do is ask them to come and complete that which you have already promised. That's all, says the apostle. Your blessing, he says. Oh, wasn't that eloquent? And look at the last phrase of the fifth verse, and this was terribly important. That the same might be ready, he says, as a matter of bounty and not as of covetousness. But in the Greek, the word covetousness is better rendered extortion. And therefore, the real sense of the text is as follows, and we've got a number of translations here that capture the textual sense of this final phrase in the fifth verse. 20th century New Testament says, it should be as a gift should be, that is, really as a matter of bounty, and not look as if it were being given under pressure. That's the word covetousness, not as of covetousness. The Amplified Bible says, not as an extortion wrung out of you, not covetousness, but as a generous and willing gift, as a matter of bounty. Jerusalem Bible says, and that it all comes as a gift out of your generosity, a matter of bounty, and not by being extorted from you, not as of covetousness. And one other translation that I think perhaps captures the same sense, and this is what the apostle wanted, you see. Now listen to this. I should like it to be a spontaneous gift and not money squeezed out of you by what I've said. Because remember, the whole spirit of this collection was to show that the method of law is to insist on conformity to a standard. But the way of grace is to inspire response to an ideal. I should like it to be a spontaneous gift, says the apostle, and not money squeezed out of you by what I have said. And so he wanted the delegates to go and to take up their blessing, which they had already promised, but in the spirit that they should give so, that they should do so. To him that soweth righteousness shall be a sure reward. Hosea chapter 10, verse 12. Sow to yourselves in righteousness, reap in mercy. Psalm 126, verses 5 to 6 says, they that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth weeping, bearing precious sheaves, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. And so again we have the relationship, because although the sowing here is sowing of tears, it's the tears of trust and confidence in God, isn't it? And they that sow in those tears shall reap in joy. There is an inevitable relationship between sowing and reaping. So that's true. None of us would deny that. In fact, the apostle in another place says, he puts it this way. He says, Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7, "Be not deceived, whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." You see the idea of connection between these two things. Whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. What we're being told in these passages is that this is a fundamental law of nature that cannot be changed or overturned. It's fundamental. That whatever you sow, that will you reap. You know, it works in two different ways. It's true, first of all, with regard to sowing in kind, isn't it? The kind of seed we sow. And so we're told in Galatians 6 later on, "He that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. He that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting." So a man reaps what he sows is true concerning the kind of seed that he sows. If you sow carrots, you will never get cabbages. You always reap what you sow as far as the kind of seed is concerned. And not only the kind of seed, but also the amount of seed. And so Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and verse 6 says, "In the morning sow thy seed, and until the evening withhold not thine hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper, either this or that, or both alike." And as far as the amount of seed, and that's really what the apostle's talking about in the 2 Corinthians 9, if you sow sparingly, you will reap sparingly. If you sow bountifully, you will reap bountifully. Whatever you sow with regard to amount, that also will you reap. It's a fundamental law of nature. Simple, really, isn't it? Ever stop to ask yourself the question, why does the apostle say, "Be not deceived"? We all know that that's true. Why does the apostle say, "Be not deceived, whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap"? You know why he says that? He says that because whilst we believe that that's true, intellectually, we actually spend our lives imagining, pretending, thinking that we can defeat that principle, don't we? We imagine that it won't really work in our lives. And what the apostle is saying is that whilst it's obvious from a farming point of view that whatsoever a man sows, that shall he reap, in our lives we think that we can overturn that principle and it won't apply. We think that we can sow a little bit and reap an enormous harvest. We do. We spend our lives trying to deceive ourselves that we can overturn a fundamental law of nature. So, whatsoever a man sows, that shall he reap. He that to the flesh sows shall of the flesh reap corruption. So we ask ourselves, what kind of seed are we sowing? And what the apostle is saying is that whatever we sow will return to haunt us. That's very important for young people particularly to understand. Don't imagine, young people particularly, that you can sow habits of the flesh and not reap them, because you will. What about our language? If we get into the habit of using language of the world, that which is unclean, that which is filthy, that which is unwise, that which is unholy. Those things will be in minds and they will return to haunt people later on. If we get into the habit of sowing that sort of language, you will reap it. Don't ever believe that you'll be able to escape from that. You cannot. It's a law of nature. What about the literature we read? If we give ourselves to those fashionable books of the world, don't ever imagine that you're not sowing things in your mind that one day will not be reaped. They will. And you will never escape from that day of reaping. It does happen. What about the music we listen to? If we fill our minds with the music of this present life and of this present world and of the heroes of this present age, most of whom are altogether filthy, we actually lose a taste for divine music and for spiritual ideas. And we get to the stage where we find it very hard to engage in the music of the truth. And we can't get that which is wrong out of our minds. And we find it sown there, and it does take root, and we do reap the consequences later on. People find that. Don't ever imagine that you can engage in those sorts of things, leisure activities, whatever it might be. Don't ever think that you can sow to the flesh and that you will not reap of the flesh. You will. And it will return to haunt you later on. Learn the lesson now that whatever you sow, you will inevitably reap. What about the amount of seed we sow? And I suppose as parents we have a responsibility. What about our young children as they grow up? From the earliest of ages, what about their courtesy? What about their respect? What about their sincerity, their integrity, their purity? You know, I believe what this is saying, and I ought to qualify this, shouldn't I? When we talk about family life, I know there are lots of things that can go wrong in families. I know that. And we're told that as far as harvest is concerned, that sometimes the birds can snatch away seed, that sometimes it could be tares or thieves, or fire, or wind, or rain, or all sorts of things that can destroy the crop that a person has sown. I know that. But you see, what the apostle is saying in the 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 6 is more than anything else. If there is a poor harvest, very often the single greatest reason is because of poor sowing. And as parents, we cannot escape that responsibility. We can't pretend to think that our children who are exposed to the world all day long, that 1 hour of Sunday school is sufficient to sow godly things, and to imagine that they will reap a crop of spiritual thoughts in later years. Young men have all sorts of visions of what they're going to be when they grow up in the truth. When they're 18 to 20, they think ahead to the days when they're going to be happily married with little children of their own, and they're going to guide them ever so wisely, and each night they're going to open their Bible, and out of their Bible will come marvellous things from the daily readings. They'll exhort, they'll lecture, they'll guide the ecclesia with wisdom, but where it's ever going to come from, we're not sure, because they're not sowing at the moment in spiritual things. Don't ever imagine, young men, that you'll be able to reap a spiritual harvest if you're not first sowing. Why, the other night in this very ecclesia, I sat here to give a lecture on Ezekiel 38, most unusual chapter. And in the front row was a row of young brethren, keen, enthusiastic, and a set of wide margin Bibles all open at the ready, and in most cases, crisp white sheets of paper on which never a mark had been seen, on a fundamental chapter of Bible prophecy that they've probably heard lectures on 500 times. Not a mark in their own Bible. It's always someone else's job, isn't it? No, it's not. We've all got to learn to sow. And young men won't guide their families and won't guide the ecclesia and won't attract the young woman who's looking for a strong young man in the truth unless they begin to sow spiritually at an early age. When I was 15... I was studying 4 hours a day, every night, including on top of whatever homework I had, and 8 hours on Saturday and 8 hours on Sunday, and it wasn't enough because already I'm behind on what I need to know. And you know what happens? And I say this to young brethren and all other middle-aged to younger brethren such as myself will know that this is true. You know what happens? When you're 18 to 20, there's always brethren to look up to ask questions. What does this mean? What does that mean? And you know what happens? You get married, you have your first child, you blink and you're 40. Isn't that true? And some brethren have blinked more than once.
Second child.
And all of a sudden, there are other young people coming up to you saying, Uncle, Uncle, that's the first warning to Uncle. Uncle so-and-so, do you know what that means in the second of Chronicles? What's the theme of Hosea chapter 2? Why does Paul say this in Romans chapter 15? I don't know, because I didn't sow. And you'll find that the years slip away ever so quick. You must start sowing now. There's nothing difficult about Bible study apart from starting it. And young women have to learn this too. You know, we have lots of young women who grow up in the truth, thinking of all the marvellous things that are going to happen to them. But some young women can't cook. Some young women can't keep home, and they've never learnt the practical realities of life. Some young sisters can't read well. They don't do anything spiritually for themselves. Do you know that in the early years of family life, a young sister often finds it very difficult with children, don't they? They're making a noise, they can never seem to get into the meeting, they miss the memorial meeting, they miss studies, and they're very much thrown on their own spiritual reserves in those early years of life, and they also have to undertake the early years of the spiritual education of their children. They've got to have their own spiritual strength. Where does that come from? Because they've sown early on in life in spiritual things. And that's what a godly young man's looking for too, by the way, is a young sister who's already shown that she herself is sowing to the things of the truth. He can see that. And you know the scariest thing of all is that some of us in the ecclesia may not be parents, but we are really. All the older brothers and sisters in the meeting are all mothers and fathers of all the children in the meeting. And all the children in an ecclesia do look up to the older ones, be they their own mother or father or other aunts or uncles. And you know how they really decide to what extent they should sow in the truth? They look at us. And they watch us. And they see what we do in Bible study, how we attend memorial meetings, whether we're at the lectures, whether we go to Bible class, whether we spend time at home in the Word, how we go about prayer. And they decide how much we ought to sow in the truth on the basis of what they see us do. And somehow we all seem to make the mistake of thinking alike that we can somehow develop a tremendous spiritual harvest from a meagre handful sparsely sown. You cannot do it, says the apostle. Don't ever deceive yourselves. It won't happen. The truth is all about sowing bountifully in whatever aspect of life we're engaged in our schoolwork, in our exams, in our responsibilities to employers, in family life, in personal study, in matters of prayer, in ecclesial responsibilities. We're asked to sow bountifully. The world that we live in is all about mediocrity. Schools in New Zealand have special funds designated to bring those that are below average up to speed. Special learning programs to bring students that are behind up to an average. Any money given for gifted students or talented students? Never. We don't want to push them ahead. We don't want them to succeed. We don't want them to do anything special. We want to bring everyone, we want to keep those ones where they are and bring those ones up to there, and we have a happy average. And everybody's in the same. Everybody's in the middle. Everyone's mediocre. That's not what the truth is all about, brothers and sisters and young people. The truth is all about striving for excellence. The truth is all about trying our hardest. The truth is all about giving our best. The truth is all about sowing bountifully. And you know why we don't? I think one of the reasons why we don't is because none of us have a really good idea as to what our harvest looks like, because the day of reaping is only going to come in the day of the judgment seat, isn't it? Oh, if we could but be transported just for a moment to the judgment seat to get a glimpse of what we're about to reap, wouldn't we want to redouble our efforts with regard to what we sow? Because we'll find to our horror this, that you see, this fundamental law of nature works so that in this way, that whatever we've sown, we could reap less than what we've sown, couldn't we, for various reasons, but you can never reap more than what you've sown. That's not possible. But we spend our lives thinking it is. You know, if ever there was a watchword to hang over our household doors, above our bedrooms, above our studies, above the kitchen, it would be this: sow bountifully. Isn't that the spirit of the truth? And that's the spirit that the apostle wanted from these brethren. Verse 7 of this 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Every man, according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give. Not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. Every man as he purposeth in his heart. Remember that phrase in Acts chapter 11. Then the disciples, every one of them, determined. You see, it's an individual thing, isn't it? The bag of the collection may have been swollen with money, coin by coin, but really the bag was full of the individual hearts and contributions of many different people in the truth. And finally, it's an individual thing. Every man, as he purposeth in his heart, as he purposeth in his heart, the Jerusalem Bible says, what he's decided in his mind. And we purpose in our heart to give according to that spirit of sowing bountifully, not just our collections, but whatever we're facing in responsibility in life, to sow according to that principle. God doesn't want the loose change in our pocket. He wants us to give according as we've purposed in our heart for the sake of the truth. Not grudgingly, says the verse, and the word means literally under grief, not under grief, or of necessity, and the word means compulsion, not under grief nor under compulsion, for God loveth a cheerful giver. You know when he says not under grief, that actually comes from Deuteronomy chapter 15. Let's have a look at that. Deuteronomy chapter 15. He says, I want you to give not grudgingly. You know, that is taken up from a phrase lifted out of Numbers chapter 15. Sorry, not Numbers, Deuteronomy chapter 15. And the whole context of this chapter is of our attitude to those who are needy among us. See verse 4, save when there shall be no poor among you, for Yahweh shall greatly bless thee. Verse 6, Yahweh thy God blesseth thee. Verse 7, if there be among you a poor man. All the way through these verses is the spirit of giving for the needs of others. Now here's the one we want in verse 10. Well, when you do have a poor brother, says the law, thou shalt surely give him, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him, because that for this thing Yahweh thy God shall bless thee in all thy works. Thy heart shall not be grieved, says the apostle, quoting from this very statement in Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 10. He says, let every man give according as he's purposed in his heart, not under grief, says the apostle, and extracts that principle out of Deuteronomy 15, that when they gave to the poor, they were to open thine hand and to give with generosity of spirit, in the knowledge that God would be pleased to bless them if they had been gracious towards others. Isn't that a remarkable thing? That here is the apostle endeavouring to gather a collection that was the answer to the Judaists, and the spirit of striving after law. And the apostle is going to set before them an ideal whereby we're inspired to greater things by the spirit of grace at work in our own lives. And you know where he finds his answer? Out of the law of Moses. He takes his argument on this occasion straight out of the law of Moses and says there's the spirit of grace in the law itself as to how they were to give. And so coming back to the 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and at the end of the 7th verse, We're told there, every man, according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly, not of compulsion, for God loveth a cheerful giver. God loveth a cheerful giver, and that quotation, by the way, that statement in the end of the seventh verse, is in fact drawn from the Septuagint version of Proverbs 22, verses 8 and 9. I'll just read those out to you, but you might like to take a note of the reference. Here's Proverbs 22, verses 8 and 9 in the Septuagint translation. He that sows wickedness shall reap troubles, and shall fully receive the punishment of his deeds. God loves a cheerful and liberal man, but a man shall fully prove the folly of his works. He that has pity on the poor shall himself be maintained, for he has given of his bread to the poor. He that gives liberally secures victory and honour, but he takes away the life of them that possess them. And there is where we believe the apostle draws the final statement here, the Lord loves a cheerful giver. But Proverbs says that God loves a cheerful and liberal man. But when the apostle takes that up, he changes the word man and converts it into the word giver, because that's the spirit of what this chapter is all about, that of giving generously in the matter of the poor fund. Now, what a marvellous appeal is contained then in these seven verses. As the apostle exhorts the brethren to careful preparation, and above all to that spirit of sowing generously, sowing bountifully, sowing spontaneously, sowing liberally, not just in their collections, but in whatever they might set their hand to, as a course for life itself, motivated by the spirit of God's grace at work in their own lives. How could you not give, brothers and sisters, to such a wonderful collection after you'd been exhorted in that way by the Apostle Paul? We take up that spirit in our own labours today. In the words of a hymn, few in number, little flock, by the world despised, forgot. Fear not, arm ye for the fight, God will bless you with his might. If you faint not, you shall reap. Israel's God the seed doth keep. Do but sow it, it will grow, though the way you may not know. Brave the foe, proclaim the word, sons and daughters of the Lord. Work ye for the Lord of heaven. Give as he hath freely given. Ye who have the truth received by God's grace to you revealed, should you dare to keep it back, you the rich reward may lack.